Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell shuts down Senator Elizabeth Warren.
I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Warren pushes back.
When I'm reading something, a truthful statement from Coretta Scott King, the answer is nope, can't say that. Well, I'm going to tell you this. They can shut me up, but they can't change the truth.
And while we're speaking of women who persisted, here's a surprising tangent. Did 19th century Mormon polygamy help drive the women's movement?
We think that the women's rights movement is about right to wages, right to divorce. In truth, many Mormon women already had those rights.
We'll talk about that and check in on sports with Bill Littlefield coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. She persisted. Those words, released in a statement by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have become a viral sensation. That after McConnell invoked a rarely used Senate rule to shut down Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren last night. Now, if you're just catching up to this story, here's the play-by-play. Last night, the Senate continued debate on Senator Jeff Sessions' nomination for Attorney General. The Senate chamber was almost empty when Senator Warren stood to speak. She read letters from opponents of Sessions' 1986 nomination to the federal judiciary, including an excerpt from a letter from the late Senator Ted Kennedy.
He is, I believe, a disgrace to the Justice Department, and he should withdraw his nomination and resign his position. Those were the words of Senator Ted Kennedy. And I will stand with Senator Kennedy, and like he did, I will cast my vote against the nomination of Senator Sessions.
Well, then, Senator Warren went on to read a letter that was virtually unknown a mere 24 hours ago. It's from Coretta Scott King, late wife of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And then an extraordinary series of events followed. They quickly unfolded. You'll hear Senator Warren and Republican Senator Steve Daines, who was presiding.
A person who has exhibited so much hostility to the enforcement of those laws.
The senator is reminded that it is a violation of Rule 19 of the standing rules of the Senate to impute to another senator or senators any conduct or motive unworthy or becoming a senator.
Mr. President, I don't think I quite understand. I'm reading a letter from Coretta Scott King to the Judiciary Committee from 1986 that was admitted into the record. I'm simply reading what she wrote about what the nomination of Jeff Sessions to be a federal court judgment and what it would mean in history for her.
This is a reminder, not pertinent necessarily to what you just shared. However, you stated that a sitting senator is a disgrace to the Department of Justice.
I think that may have been Senator Kennedy. Although I would be glad to repeat it in my own words.
The rule applies. To imputing conduct or motive through any form or voice to a sitting form of words includes quotes, articles, or other materials.
So quoting Senator Kennedy calling then nominee Sessions a disgrace is a violation of Senate rules.
Well, Senator Warren was warned, as you heard, but she continued, but then was stopped again, this time by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
There's a piece from the Bedford Minuteman that really tells the story of how sexual violence impacts Massachusetts. And this is what it said. They are mothers, daughters, sisters, fathers, sons, and brothers.
Mr. President.
They are
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The senators impugn the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
And that was it. A highly unusual moment in the United States Senate. The Senate then took a party line vote upholding the ruling that Warren violated Rule 19, which says, as you heard, senators are not allowed to, quote, directly or indirectly impute another senator. Then Warren was ordered to sit down and is not allowed to speak during the remainder of the session's debate, which continues today in advance of a vote expected this evening. However, last night, Warren left the Senate chamber and did read the entire letter from Coretta Scott King. She did that on Facebook Live. And soon after, McConnell himself issued a statement. That one has since gone viral. He said, quote, she was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless, she persisted. Senator Elizabeth Warren joins us now. Senator, welcome. And as you heard, you persisted. Why?
I persisted because it was the right thing to do. I was doing my job. I went down to the floor of the United States Senate late yesterday with a speech I'd worked on for a long time in order to debate whether or not Jeff Sessions should be the next Attorney General of the United States. And as part of my speech, what I wanted to do was read a letter from Coretta Scott King, who discussed what Jeff Sessions had done back in Alabama when he was the U.S. Attorney for Alabama. She, in her letter, she walks through his prosecution of civil rights workers. Mm-hmm. He prosecuted them when they were trying to help elderly African Americans vote. And this letter is powerful, it's deeply moving, and an important historical document. And back in 1986, it helped move a Republican-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee to reject his appointment as a federal judge.
But that very same letter, Senator Warren, as you know, Republican senators last night felt was impugning Jeff Sessions, and that's the problem they had with it.
Well, you know, evidently what they seem to think impugning means is just talking about the facts and what happened, what Jeff Sessions' actions have said. You know, if I can, I'll just read the little bit that I read that I got in trouble for. Coretta Scott King describes what had happened, and she said, Mr. Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. And that's when they shut me down.
Senator Warren, as you know, today, several male senators, Democrats, were allowed to enter the letter into the record and read parts of it, and they were not interrupted. Rule 19 was not levied on them. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know what to make of it, except to say I hope everyone reads Coretta Scott King's letter. It really is something to read and a reminder, a very tangible reminder of what was going on in America not so very long ago and the kinds of risks that people face today and that they need to be able to count on an attorney general who will be on their side. You know, one of the points that Coretta Scott King made in her letter is that Jeff Sessions managed with his federal prosecution to do what the local sheriffs accomplished 20 years ago with clubs and cattle prods. She talks in her letter. She says, many elderly blacks were visited multiple times by the FBI, who then hauled them over 180 miles by bus to a grand jury in Mobile, yeah, when they more easily could have testified at a grand jury 20 miles away, yeah, in Selma. She talks about the intimidation of these people, and this is all under the direction of Jeff Sessions, a man who today is just a few hours away from coming to a vote to be Attorney General of the United States.
Senator Warren, I'm curious. I mean, I can hear your passion about what you believe is what's written in this letter. But ironically, before last night, very few people knew it existed. I mean, do you think Senator Mitch McConnell has actually done you a favor? Because now this letter is absolutely everywhere, and you say you want people to read it. Thousands, if not millions, of people are.
Well, I hope that millions of people read it because, look, Megan, I get this. Democrats don't have the votes to be able to stop Jeff Sessions. We didn't have the votes to stop Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education. We just don't have the set of tools we need right now in the United States Senate. One of the things we have to count on is just basic democracy. Is enough people across this country making their voices heard? That's the only thing that's going to help us get some accountability back into this government, get this government working again, not for the rich and powerful, not for people like Jeff Sessions, getting it working again for the American people.
I have two more quick questions for you, Senator. Sure. Do you, Rule 19 is almost never invoked.
I've never heard of it.
It's been in effect since the early 1900s, and it's only been invoked a tiny handful of times.
Yeah.
The fact that it happened to you last night, do you think, has the political tenor in Washington, in the Senate in particular, become so rancorous that do you think it was Mitch McConnell was making it personal last night?
You know, for me, this is less about political rancor and more about power. This was Mitch McConnell working with Donald Trump to jam a set of nominees down the throats of the United States Senate and the people of the United States of America, to just jam them down our throats. You know, to say we don't have to get nominees who are kind of in the mainstream. We can go with the Secretary of Education who doesn't believe in public education. We can go with an Attorney General who has made it clear that he thinks his job is to prosecute people who are trying to help elderly black citizens.
But Senator Warren, if I may, as you well know, it's the president's right to nominate whomever he wants, and it's the Senate's duty, as it's doing, to debate those nominees. I mean, the process is happening.
That's what I was trying to do. You know, Mitch McConnell didn't stand up and say Coretta Scott King got the facts wrong. He didn't stand up and say, oh, her conclusion was wrong. No, he stood up and said, those facts and those conclusions are so terrible that even to whisper them on the floor of the United States Senate impugns Jeff Sessions. Think about that.
Senator Warren, I have one last question for you. You are well known to bring your heat and passion to anything that you put your mind to. You famously said a while ago that you would be willing to leave blood and teeth on the floor in your fight for financial reform. But I'm wondering if we're reaching a point now where that much passion could backfire, because here's why I ask. Senator Orrin Hatch spoke after you did last night, and he said that he's, quote, tired of your constant diatribe. And then he went on to say, I listened to her for quite a while, and she didn't have a good thing to say about a fellow senator here, and I frankly don't think that's right. If we don't respect each other, we're going down a very steep path to oblivion. Doesn't Senator Hatch have a point? I mean, look at how Americans can barely talk to each other.
You know, I think the right question is, what do you think respect means? Do you think respect means covering up the facts? Do you think respect means everyone just lines up and smiles and says, because he's a senator, we won't talk about his record? Because he's a senator, we won't talk about his voting against the Violence Against Women Act or against equal pay for equal work, things that might be relevant to whether or not he should be an attorney general. Because he's a senator, we should not talk about the fact that we may have an out-of-control president, and it may be the attorney general of the United States that we Americans have to rely on to tell the president of the United States, no, you cannot enforce an unconstitutional or illegal order. And Jeff Sessions is not that person. Now, I think that what is respectful is to treat things seriously. I look at Jeff Sessions' record, and I say that is the record of a man who cannot be entrusted as Attorney General of the United States. It is not a personal statement. I didn't hurl any ugly names. I didn't throw any invectives his way. I simply stated what I believe to be the facts, and I quoted Coretta Scott King, who saw firsthand what it meant to have Jeff Sessions in a position of power and what it meant for African Americans who were trying to vote. I think those are relevant issues, and as long as it is said as politely as I could, but with force and passion, that's what democracy is supposed to be about. That's what the Constitution is supposed to be about. That's what it's supposed to mean to be in the United States Senate. That's why the people of Massachusetts sent me there, and that's the job I'm going to do.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Washington. Matt, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you heard Senator Warren there and all her fire and passion, but give us a reality check here. I mean, is this a major moment in the Senate or a tempest in a teapot?
It is a major moment. I mean, and for some who've been looking at the Senate for a long time, it's sort of a low moment, you know, in discourse, in the animosity that is inside that chamber. You know, they often call it the world's greatest deliberative body. There was certainly no deliberation last night. You know, Senator Warren was not allowed to bring up some points on the Senate floor. There's a lot of partisanship. So I think it's a moment marking for that. It's symbolic. It won't change the outcome. You know, Jeff Sessions will likely be confirmed tonight as Attorney General. So this does not change much, but it indicates sort of how much animosity there is inside that chamber that has long been sort of a clubby place, you know, for senators.
Right. It's supposed to be the chamber of Congress that that sticks to its rules of decorum. But Matt, let me ask you, I mean, so you mentioned rightly that this vote's going to happen this evening, and it doesn't seem as if anything that's happened in the past 24 hours will derail Jeff Sessions' confirmation at this point in time. But is there a larger sense amongst the GOP that perhaps it was ill-advised for them to issue Rule 19 against Senator Warren yesterday, because all of a sudden they've handed her this giant megaphone?
Yeah, and she has certainly used it and used it well. The irony in this is she was speaking last night at about 8 o'clock on a weeknight. Viewership on C-SPAN 2 is not that high, you know, at that hour. And had Mitch McConnell not protested her comments, her reading of this letter, it would not have gotten nearly the attention that it has. Senator Warren went to Facebook Live after she was reprimanded and read from just outside the chamber of the Senate, and that's been viewed more than 8 million times. She was trending on Twitter. You know, there's a lot of attention today to her, to this letter. It's getting a whole lot more attention than it would have otherwise gotten. There's a lot of fundraising being done, on both sides, really, off of this moment. I think in that sense, attacking Warren and attacking her for reading a letter from a civil rights icon such as Coretta Scott King, I think may have been ill-advised for Republicans to try and pick this battle the way that they have.
Mm. And so, I mean, do you see this having any longer-term impact then? Does this further empower Warren, or is it sort of teaching the GOP maybe the best thing to do is to not draw any attention to anything she says?
Well, I think that's sort of to be determined a little bit. I think that this episode has shown just how big of a megaphone that Elizabeth Warren has, and her ability, sort of unique ability that she's had for a while to kind of capitalize on moments like this. Ever since she rose to the Senate, she's been very attuned to social media, to raising money across the country, and to sort of capturing the attention in a sort of unique way. And I think this is once again proving that. Republicans, though, think that they benefit as well, you know, from casting Elizabeth Warren as out of touch, as a liberal from Massachusetts. You'll notice from last night some of the early moments where Warren was reprimanded was because she was quoting Ted Kennedy,
right?
You know, another person that Republicans sort of had loved to to cast aside as a liberal from Massachusetts, you know. And so I think that there's an element where Republicans think that they can benefit by having Elizabeth Warren as sort of a boogie woman, I guess, you know, in the Senate. So I think that both sides will sort of maybe try and learn from this and going forward. But, you know, there's certainly no love at this point between Elizabeth Warren and the Trump administration, Mitch McConnell. You know, there's certainly issues that she probably cares about and would like to work on. But I think that's, you know, the atmosphere inside the Senate is very, you know, sour at this point.
Sour, to say the least. Well, Matt Visor is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And since you are listening on a Wednesday afternoon, you know it's time for our regular check-in with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
So a couple minor sports stories happening.
Yeah, wasn't much of a week, huh?
Look, you and I spent weeks talking about the Super Bowl, and I want to ask you what your take was, because you, more than anyone that I know, loves a great sports story.
Absolutely.
And Sunday was the greatest.
It's not fair, is it, though, that Tom Brady, with all of the accomplishments that he can claim and all of the ways in which he has been celebrated over the years, and he's certainly in the conversation for greatest quarterback ever and most accomplished and all that he should also be the quarterback of the team that makes the greatest comeback in the history of the Super Bowl? It doesn't seem fair,
right?
That all of this should accrue to one man.
True. Not fair, but maybe logical, right?
Well,
maybe.
You know, logical, and it brings up that wonderful conversation that you can always have in a circumstance like this, which is, did the Patriots do a magnificent job of coming back and taking over that game, or did Atlanta simply fall on its face when the game was certainly seemed to be within the Falcons' reach? And, of course, it's the sort of conversation that will never be entirely settled, but it's great fun.
And, I mean, I have to say, one of the things that we've talked about a couple times since Sunday with various folks is this idea of mental toughness, and mm-hmm. that's one of the things that the Patriots showed to, you know, the nth degree on Sunday. And I just wanted to ask you about that, because I feel like, you know, whatever you think about the NFL, whatever you think about football, athletes showing grit is inspirational for people at any level.
It's part of the recipe for winning. There's no question about that. And I thought it was especially interesting when you're watching a game on television, and they're able now, with the way television works, to get so close and the facial expressions of these guys on the sidelines. And I got to say, during a big portion of that game, Tom Brady looked as if he was just absolutely dismayed by what was going on. He did not look like grit was boiling up at that time. But when the opportunity presented itself, boy, did they take advantage of it.
Yeah. You know, my personal measure for how scary the game felt for a long time was, I live in a rather densely crowded neighborhood, and it was really quiet a lot of Sunday night.
And there was no traffic.
That's right, until the great cheering at the end.
Right.
All right, well, let's move on. And I'm afraid we're going to have to inject a little bit of politics into the sports conversation.
That never bothers me. I welcome the opportunity.
Well, Patriots defensive captain Devin McCourtney, he's the second Pats player now to say that he will not be accepting President Donald Trump's invite to the White House. Martellus Bennett has also said he declined the traditional invite. Bennett says that though he won't attend the celebration, he doesn't fault any teammates who do plan to go. Here he is.
I support those guys. If whoever wants to go, I still support those guys as well. But I mean, it's just a personal belief and a personal thing for me.
So what do you make of it?
I think McCourtney's explanation was about as good as it gets. He said, I don't feel welcome there. Mm. You know, given the attitudes that have been expressed by the current president, I don't feel welcome there.
Yeah.
I don't see how you can be any more clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, as we've discussed before, Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, Pat's owner Robert Kraft are known to be friends of Donald Trump. One would think that politics don't actually play a role on the gridiron itself, but could there be any tension in the postseason or next season?
I doubt it. I think probably everybody you've mentioned is thoroughly committed to having the team do as well as it possibly can, and everybody realizes they have to, as Bill Belichick sometimes puts it, do their job for that to happen. But I don't know Bill Belichick very well, and I don't know Robert Kraft very well, so who knows what lurks in the hearts of men.
Okay. Well, let's move on to that other Boston team, which is just getting going, because we have like a
truck
few,
day.
Truck day. And today we have a few hours in which it kind of feels like spring. Not like that's going to last. So obviously, we're not going to have Big Poppy at spring training this year. He was done in October. What do you think of the Red Sox as they head towards spring training?
Well, you know, the question that some people have been asking is who is going to replace David Ortiz, Big Poppy? And the answer is nobody, because his presence was so enormous. Not only was he a terrific hitter, but his personality was such that he took an awful lot of the heat off anybody who perhaps was sitting in the locker room and didn't much want to talk to the press.
Right.
You know, they could always go over and talk to David Ortiz. So nobody's going to replace him. But by all measures, the Red Sox look like they have a terrific team. My friend, a retired baseball coach who used to coach at Groton and Lawrenceville, and he wrote me a postcard the other day, and he said, the Red Sox pitching staff is obscene.
Obscene.
That's how good he thinks it is, right?
Well, if Anthony Brooks were here right now, he'd be saying, Magna, Mookie Betts, swoon!
Right. They've got lots of players who've come up and who are developing into the, what should be the primes of their careers. And then they got some kids that Andrew Benintendi is a terrific prospect who should do nothing but get better. There's all kinds of reasons to feel very good about opening day, if it ever does get here.
It will. Trust me. It'll just take its time, but it'll get here. Let's check in really quickly with yet another big Boston team, and that, of course, is the Celtics, because Boston fans are going to say goodbye to Paul Pierce. He spent 15 years with the Celts. I love that. I love players who stick with teams, I have to say.
Yes, and it's not always something that they get to decide to do. They get traded around at the whim of coaches and owners. But, Paul Pierce's final goodbye to Boston was a three-pointer. And it was the best of all worlds because he sunk the three-pointer at the end of the game and the Celtics won anyway. And so the Celtics crowd gave him a great send-off. And this is one of the fun things about sports when a player has been on the same team for a good long time, even if he comes back as a member of the opposition.
Yeah.
And people kind of look back into their memories and they think about, oh, boy, I remember the night that guy hit a three-pointer at the buzzer or whatever it might be. And you know, what a good player he'd been for such a long time. And there is a real sense of appreciation that has nothing to do with, oh, winning a championship. It's more of a long-term relationship kind of appreciation, and it's really quite a nice thing.
Exactly. Well, Paul Pierce himself had some words about that when he talked about all the love that he felt the city of Boston has given him over the years. Here he is.
You know, this is something I truly felt tonight, the appreciation of what I've been able to give this city and what they've been able to give me, you know, not only on the court, but off the court, too.
Yeah, he said that on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Hey, Bill, we've got just enough time. I'd love to hear what's coming up on Only a Game this weekend.
Well, we have a basketball story about a kid who's the ball boy for the basketball team at UNC, and his dad writes about basketball for UNC. And so this kid got to be the ball boy, and when the halftime show doesn't last as long as it should or doesn't show up on time or whatever, he goes out and he takes half-court shots. And you're going to love the story on Only a Game about how his half-court shots turned out on a recent evening down in North Carolina.
Well, I will definitely be tuning in at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. on Saturdays. That's when you can hear Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And he joins us on Wednesdays here at Radio Boston. Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity, Magna.
You're always welcome. We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Traffic snarls and dangerous, slippery sidewalks this morning. All that ice gave way to spring-like temperatures this afternoon, and now we're looking forward tomorrow to snow. So let's get a check-in on the weather with WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Hi there, David.
Hello, Magna. What a day, huh?
First of all, before we talk about tomorrow, did your plants survive the ice yesterday and today?
Yeah, that wasn't enough ice to really do any damage. As a matter of fact, I have the cold frame open this afternoon, and I was actually munching on some arugula that's still growing in there. So
good. Well, I mean, I heard some emergency rooms had lines out the door with people who were slipping and sliding. But now we've got to look forward to a big storm tomorrow. How much snowfall are we likely to see?
Yeah, it's 51 degrees right now at Logan Airport, and we have a pretty major snowstorm on the way for tomorrow. We're looking at generally, you can think of everyone that's listening is mostly going to be between 8 and 14 inches. So, you know, is someone going to get 11 and someone else get 9? Yeah, sure. Someone gets 14, but mostly just plan on just under a foot or a little bit over a foot. The other thing about this storm, we do have a blizzard warning up along the coastline south of Boston. That includes Cape Cod and the islands. And that's because of the visibility. Remember, blizzards don't necessarily have anything to do with the amount of snow. It's just that visibility will be under a quarter mile or less for 3 hours in a row from blowing snow and snow and winds over 35 miles an hour. So travel will be difficult along the coastline tomorrow.
Okay. When's the snowfall likely to start? I'm seeing in the early, early hours tomorrow.
Yeah, so it's going to start tomorrow morning, right around the morning commute. If you need to get into work tomorrow, I suggest getting, you know, into Boston. Let's say that's where you're headed. If you get into Boston by, say, 6, 7, even 8 o'clock in the morning, I think you'll be okay. You might be driving in a little bit of snow, but we're not talking a major snowstorm at that point. It's after 10 o'clock that things really start to ramp up. And between 10 and, say, 5 o'clock, that's when the core of the storm will be here. The evening commute more impacted because there'll be all that snow on the ground by that time.
It just sounds pretty wretched from top to bottom, if you ask me. Okay, David, one last question. I'm keeping my fingers that the answer is no. But with this late snowstorm, are we likely to see a lot more snow? Is there any chance we could have, you know, another winter of 2015?
It's highly unlikely. That was already by this time in 2015. We had one major blizzard at the end of January, another one in early February. And I just don't see that kind of pattern. That was sort of, you know, it's not that it couldn't happen again in 3, 4, 10, 20 years, but those things usually generally do not happen so close together. And as a matter of fact, we're looking at a few snow showers over the weekend, maybe a little bit of light accumulation, but I'm not looking at anything big. And then next week, right now, temperatures upper 30s, lower 40s. We'll see some melting. So this is not going to turn into some crazy snowy pattern.
I just hope I didn't jinx us by asking. Okay.
I hope I didn't by saying it's not going to happen either.
WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joining us via Skype. David, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
Well-behaved women seldom make history. You've probably heard that phrase. It's a rallying cry for many women who seek to challenge the odds at home, at work, or in society. And it was originally written back in 1976 by historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She's the groundbreaking Harvard historian who won a Pulitzer Prize and a Bancroft Prize for A Midwife's Tale. And she's out now with a new book on women in polygamist marriages in the early Mormon church. The book is called A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism. And Ulrich paints a beautiful picture of the everyday lives of women in the church. And she argues that 19th century Mormon polygamy may have actually helped drive part of the early women's rights movements. Ulrich is a MacArthur Fellow and past president of the American Historical Association and the Mormon History Association, and she joins us now in the studio. Professor Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's an absolute delight to have you. First of all, I should say, help me untie the confused knot in my mind, because when I first hear Mormon polygamy, the very next thought I can tell you is not, help drives feminism.
No.
What's going on here?
Well, it's a terrific puzzle, which is why it made a good topic for a book. I mean, we all like contradictions. And the notion of Mormon women as somehow, you know, shackled to an old-fashioned patriarchy. And yet the interesting thing is women in early Utah, which was the center of Mormon migration in the middle of the 19th century, were actually the first in the nation to cast a vote. Wyoming passed a women's suffrage bill, but Utah had an election first. And there were a lot more people, a lot more voters in Utah, including a lot more women. And they voted in 1870. They also participated in a constitutional convention to write a new constitution as Utah was trying to become a state.
Uh-huh.
And argued they were first in the world to do that.
Okay, so let me ask you, was we'll get to the polygamy part, of course,
yeah,
in just a moment here.
Yeah.
But regarding women's suffrage in Utah, I mean, so was it church teaching? Was it church elders? Who decided that, yes, far before the nation as a whole gave them the right to vote, that they should do so in Utah?
Well, it's a really interesting story. It's kind of a political story. We know that the women's suffrage movement began to take off in 1869, when Congress was giving African Americans, males, the right to vote, and women said, well, let's give women the right to vote. And Congress declined to do that. And so there was a lot of press coverage. And somebody in the New York Times said, oh, I know who we should give the right to vote. We should give those polygamous women in Utah, and then they can get rid of this terrible system. Well, the polygamist women in Utah thought that was a terrific idea. They asked the territorial legislature. The territorial legislature passed women's suffrage as partly a response to a draconian anti-polygamy legislation that had passed the U.S. House.
Right.
So it was a political demonstration, but it also laid the groundwork for longstanding participation in the national women's rights
movement. Oh, that is so fascinating. So polygamous women were given women's suffrage early in part as a response to anti-polygamy legislation.
Exactly.
Which they opposed.
Yes. So they stood up, defended polygamy, and demanded their rights as citizens. And it just confused everybody and still confuses people today.
I'm raising my hand. I'll be perfectly honest. I still do feel a little confused.
Yes.
So give us a little bit of the background here then. I mean, how, when, and why, for people who don't know the history of the church, did polygamy become part of Mormonism in the 19th century, of course.
It was in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Well, it became part of Mormonism in the 1840s in a utopian LDS community on the Mississippi River. Nauvoo, Illinois, is where the Latter-day Saints gathered. The church was founded in 1830, so it's very new, very new. And they're building a community that they believe will welcome Jesus when he comes again. Mm-hmm. This was a period in the 19th century when everyone imagined, you know, that millennial moment. And the practice began in secret and rather slowly around the first of the Mormon prophets, Joseph Smith,
mm-hmm.
and then spread to a few of his followers. But when he was murdered in 1844 and Brigham Young became the successor, he embraced this new teaching, and there was a huge expansion of what they called plural marriage at that point. And they felt it was biblical.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so what was their justification?
Yeah, their justification is this is the blessing of Abraham. Going back to the Old Testament, God gave Abraham Sarah, and Sarah gave Abraham Hagar. And therefore, polygamy was at the very beginning.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, Joseph Smith didn't sort of explain why this made sense in the 19th century. He just said, God told me to do it.
Right.
And the women who were married to Joseph Smith, we don't know what kind of relationship that was. They refer to it as sealing. So women who were spiritually sealed to Joseph Smith became some of the most important female leaders in the church. And some of those women were on the platform in 1870 when they were defending polygamy and asking for the vote.
Well, of course, as you hinted earlier, I mean, from the start, polygamy was a highly controversial practice.
Highly controversial.
And Mormonism was, that's one of the reasons why external viewers of Mormonism often referred to the religion as a cult. But let me ask you, I mean, let's get back to the heart of what your book is about. And that is that you uncover a history here where plural marriage or polygamy allowed, you say, women to do things and to advance women's rights in a way that they otherwise might not have?
Well, it's a really, really complicated story. Not everybody loved it, but those who embraced it and attempted to create really a communal society where everybody mattered and everyone belonged, became very adept at working collaboratively in women's organizations for collaborative economic activities. Women could own property. There were many ways in this society where they had rights that were not available to monogamous women in other parts of the country. So essentially no-fault divorce. And it's interesting, there are just some fascinating stories of women who left an abusive marriage, perhaps an alcoholic husband, to become Latter-day Saints and then profess themselves very happy to be in a household with other women. Mm. So it's not just about relationships with men. It's relationships among women themselves in cooperative housekeeping and child raising and charitable activities of many kinds.
Now, your book is based on years of scholarship drawing from, obviously, the diaries and letters, meeting notes written at the time. What are some of the things, I mean, what do the women themselves have to say from these diaries and letters?
Well, they, wonderful statement from a Boston woman, actually, a school teacher in Boston who became the third plural wife of Brigham Young. And she said, "I want the liberty to choose my own husband." It's a very interesting concept. What she meant was, I want to be married to Brigham Young. He's already married. He's happy to add me to his household, and I will do that. Other women found themselves dismayed, particularly first wives, when their husband felt he was had a kind of responsibility to reach out and make sure every woman in the community had a family, had a household, and they would complain. Some of them left, which they had the right to do. So there are a range of feelings about it, but I think the central core is they believed this was to transcend selfishness and to create a community where every woman had a home and the right to have a family.
Okay. So, Professor Ulrich, I have to say, I'm still not quite seeing the connection between these rights that you just laid out and the communal strength that you were talking about.
Yes.
That women may have felt in these plural marriages. And how that translates to political power or the women's movement writ larger. Because in my mind, I'm still seeing these polygamous marriages as unions that are approved of by a patriarchal church, right?
Uh-huh.
And so how does that then break out and influence women's rights writ large?
Well, it's a patriarchal and matriarchal church. So the highest order of priesthood in the church is to be sealed in an eternal marriage. And so women also have, they heal, bless the sick. They have ritual blessings for women in childbirth. They develop, for example, there's a council of health that oversees healthcare in the territory. They're notoriously suspicious of physicians, particularly those that use, you know, opium and mercurial remedies that are highly dangerous at the time, bloodletting, those kinds of things. So they believe in gentle medicine, herbal medicine, and that's very female-centered. And they kind of organize, and they're part of the kind of oversight of healthcare in the community. They're also involved in caring for immigrants and doing cooperative work to raise money. One of the fascinating little details about their political activity in 1870 is that a group of them had built a hall, a women's hall, where they met together on the upper floor. And on the lower floor, they sold things that they had made cooperatively. They raised the money to build the building, didn't want anyone's help to do it. So it's, you know, it's a commonplace that women's political activity often grows out of concern for other people. So we think of the early petitioning activities for the anti-slavery movement,
right,
or petitions against the removal of Cherokees. And the Latter-day Saint movement began in the same period, and women were already involved in these kinds of activities, petitioning for redress of having lost their land in Missouri when they were mobbed and sent out of there.
But I have to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, but the church was forced to disavow polygamy when Utah wanted statehood, right?
Exactly. So they had six different petitions for statehood beginning in the 1840s and going to the 1890s. And it was a strong fight. So when the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that the anti-polygamy legislation was constitutional, then they backed down and publicly abandoned polygamy. It took a while to make that happen, and received statehood in 1896. Long after they had had the population and the infrastructure to justify.
Right. And of course, we should note that there are still some practitioners who, they're not formally sanctioned by the church, of course.
No,
outside the church.
They're a small number.
Yeah. Professor Ulrich, you yourself are a Mormon.
Yes.
I'm just curious what it meant to you and your understanding of your own faith to research this history.
Oh, it was an amazing experience, because it was going back to things that I thought I knew. And, you know, the things you get as stories from your grandparents are not the same thing as being a professional historian and diving into the archives. So I was surprised about lots of things.
Yeah.
That, for example, there was it was a very charismatic faith. I mean, today Mormons are kind of well-behaved.
There's that phrase again.
I mean, maybe a little boring. I mean, it depends. But in the 19th century, there was a lot of speaking in tongues, a lot of kind of public ritual healing, dancing, dancing in the temple with the fiddle. Very expressive, very emotionally demonstrative group of people.
Well, we've just got about a minute and a half left. And before we run out of time, I really want to ask you one more thing.
Okay.
Because we started the conversation when I was quoting what is possibly your most famous written sentence ever.
Yes.
Well-behaved women seldom make history.
Yeah.
You wrote that, what, in 1976?
Yes.
And it was about Puritans, right?
It was about Puritan funeral sermons, for heaven's sake.
And people, I mean, it's like on bumper stickers now.
Oh, it's everywhere.
People take that as a line of that you were writing in support of disruptive behavior, but that's not what it was about, right?
No, originally it was saying, hey, let's pay attention to the people who don't make trouble and let's learn about them. But of course, I've totally embraced all the meanings, because it's so much fun. It's the ambiguity, really. And I think what's really wonderful is when someone who looks like, you know, goody two-shoes stands up and speaks up for herself, you know, people really listen because it's so surprising.
Do you consider yourself well-behaved?
Oh, of course not.
Thank goodness, I have to say. Well, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is a professor of history at Harvard University. Her new book is A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism, 1835 to 1870. She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the Bancroft Prize. She's also a MacArthur Fellow. She's really a giant in the world of American history. Professor Ulrich, it has been such an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.